This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
Well, yesterday we finished the newest edition of the Trumpet print magazine, and the headline on the cover talks about the most exciting news event we could possibly talk about. It says, "A new government is coming," and it quotes Mark 13 and verse 26, "And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory." With all the problems that are occurring in the governments of this world, the promise of a new government really is an exciting thing to set your mind on. And that's what we're going to be doing this Sabbath, starting at sunset tonight. This is actually also the biblically commanded Day of Trumpets. This holy day pictures the second coming of Jesus Christ, which is the only hope for this weary world. And all the news events that we talk about on the program today, and really every week on this program, point toward that greatest of all events that will occur in the near future. We aim to show you how we're seeing the prophecies of the Bible unfold before us, prophecies that God gave us to show how we're approaching nearer and nearer the return of his Son. So watch for that new Trumpet edition up at thetrumpet.com next week. And now we will turn to the news of this past week. If you watch news media in America, you're hearing a whole lot about COVID-19. You're hearing about the coming presidential election. You're hearing about how anti-science the Trump administration is. What you're not hearing about is how President Trump helped facilitate what the Jerusalem Post is calling a new Middle East, thanks to the peace deals Israel is making with Arab states in the region. You have been hearing about it on this program, but on Tuesday this week, the Abraham Accords were signed at the White House, not just between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, but also with Bahrain. To learn more about this, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Last week on the program, we were talking about Israel's normalization with the United Arab Emirates and talking about how it was going to be signed next week and that perhaps there would be somebody else there sitting at the table. And just as after we recorded, the president tweeted that Bahrain was going to join on these accords. And so it was, as you said, on September 15th, we did have a big ceremony at the White House, an amazing, really, ceremony with Israel side by side with President Trump and two Arab states, the third and fourth peace agreements that the state of Israel has made with Arab states that it hasn't gone to war with before. And as you said, given what the world has thought of the key to Middle East peace was, that is the key being Arab states and Israel coming together and how that's going to usher in, if that can be solved, then we're on good soil, fertile soil for the future of peace in the world. You would expect there to be more fanfare around this. There is certainly fanfare in the Middle East, in Israel, also in Bahrain, and also in the United Arab Emirates over this deal, and yet you couldn't see much of it being celebrated elsewhere in the United States and even in Europe, which is quite bizarre. And it shows you just that side point of how little you can actually trust the news that most Americans or people in the West are seeing on their television as being the most important events of the day. Because here, this definitely was the most important event of the day, especially including Bible prophecy, and yet it wasn't reported. And so this is a deal that is being spoken of throughout the Middle East, especially in Israel, as one that is changing up the security alliances for sure, changing up potentially the future of how Israel can dwell with other Arab states. And there's a lot of people that see this as a very hopeful thing for the future, given that there have been changes inside these Arab states that indicates that this is, at least for now, it is a sincere attempt to bring Israel together alongside with their nations, and of course being brokered by the U.S. president, with lots of benefits for both countries as well.
Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily radio show and underlined that point about just how anti-Trump the press is, the way that they reported about this or failed to report about it. And the clip that just dumbfounded me the most was watching Wolf Blitzer from CNN grilling Jared Kushner, not talking about the deal itself, but the fact that when they announced the deal that the gathered crowd were sitting too close together and not wearing masks. He was more concerned about that than he was about the historic nature of this deal. And it is remarkable just how blinded to what is going on there the press really is. What's interesting from our perspective, from the Trumpet's perspective, is all of the celebration that's going on. It really is interesting, and it's obvious why people are so excited. The fact that this that they were able to make these deals to kind of break, as you mentioned, the historic resistance to doing any kind of a deal apart from resolving the issue with the Palestinians. The fact that that deadlock has been broken, first of all, that really is quite extraordinary. Maybe we could just talk about that before we talk about prophecy or anything beyond that.
Yeah, I think that is something that's astronomical to realize, that the Arab states have always said that you have to have peace with the Palestinian people, Israel, before we accept you into the community. And that's just been thrown out. There, you know, when the UAE announced that they were going to normalize ties back on August 14th, they mentioned that the tweet came out that we have agreed that Israel is not going to annex the West Bank. That's the reason that we're going forward on this, so that the Palestinian state idea can be preserved. Okay, well then go ahead and read the actual accord that was signed, all three pages of it, and there's nothing in there about the Palestinians' annexation, a Palestinian state. This is a straight-up deal with Arab states and the Israelis, with the Palestinian issue not being a factor. And I think today on the Trumpet Daily, Mr. Fleury had a remarkable clip of John Kerry, a former negotiator of Palestinian-Israeli peace, saying it's absolutely impossible, not going to happen, never, no, not going to happen. He was very dogmatic about this, that peace between an Arab state and Israel is not going to be possible unless peace between the Palestinians have been worked out first. And President Trump has flipped a switch on this, and he said that, no, let's go after the Arab states first, and let's then go to the Palestinians to pressure them.
The fact that Bahrain joined on board definitely lends weight to that narrative, and President Trump has been promising that there are more Arab states coming.
Yeah, it's what would happen was the UAE and even Kushner, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who's headed up these peace efforts, he spoke about this, that the reason Bahrain took a couple of weeks is they were seeing what would happen to the UAE. They were seeing what the Arab world's response was going to be. They were seeing what the populations of the UAE were, whether they'd be upset, whether they'll riot, what did the other countries think about it. And since it was warmly embraced by everyone apart from the Palestinians, Iran, and Turkey, Bahrain jumped on board. And Bahrain's got a majority Shiite, which they've got to wrestle with a lot of Iranian influence in their nation. And yet they thought that it was still going to be a good idea. And none of these deals would be signed on to if the Saudis didn't support it. That's the big fish. If that happens, and I think it will, and I think most others think it will eventually, it's going to be a shocking turnaround for Israel's relationship with these nations in the short term in the region.
Well, the fact that Saudi Arabia allowed the Israeli jetliner to cross over its airspace is a good indication that Saudi Arabia is at least on board with the fundamentals of what is happening here. Exactly what it would take for it to sign on itself remains to be seen. But just to underline the point of prophecy that we have made, as we've talked about this before, as celebratory as the mood is right now, it should be tempered if you understand what prophecy says is going to be happening with these anti-Iranian states that we see aligning with Israel today.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've talked about the security arrangement that is being worked out, and obviously these nations want Israel security support in the face of a growing threat of Iran. We know that Iran is the king of the South in biblical prophecy. That is the belligerent actor, the pushy actor, the one that does try and take over other Middle Eastern states, not just Israel. And they're on the mission to do that. And so these Arab states are scared of that. They need support. The United States wants to leave. And so it is setting up an Arab-type NATO. Really what we saw in the post-World War II era in Europe, when the United States had forces on the ground there and it wanted to keep Russia out and keep Germany down. In this case, you've got the United States that is wanting to remove itself and is going to want to keep Iran out of the Middle East, and as Israel is acting as kind of the de facto American forces inside the Middle East, that's going to guarantee the security. And that's how the United States sees it. That's how a lot of political commentators see it, strategic analysts, that this is all about countering Iran and preserving status quo. But the Bible says that the nations that Israel are aligning with right now, the biblical Ishmaelites, as they are referred to, both in history and prophecy, it says that the Ishmaelites are going to be a part of the force that actually fights against the state of Israel going forward. And I think this is really fascinating. Even Melanie Phillips, in her piece about this today, she talked about how in the Bible prophesied about the Ishmaelites and how that they would be saved by the Almighty. You remember Ishmael was sent off. He's the son of Hagar, who was a fill-in surrogate for Sarah when she couldn't have a baby during Abraham's time. And eventually he was sent away. And so was Hagar, his mother. And God said, don't worry, I'll look after them. They will become a great nation. And she says here in her piece that God declared that, and they did become a great nation. And so here you have just a political commentator talking about history and seeing that the Ishmaelites are these, the UAE, the Arabs, the Saudis, they are the Ishmaelites. And yet, take it one step further, look at prophecy, of what prophecy says about the Ishmaelite nation, mm-hmm. and it is going to be the one that turns against Israel. And you can see that in Psalm chapter 83. We've talked about that quite a lot. And if you can read Mr. Stephen Flory's article about that from this week. It wasn't about necessarily Psalm 83, but this whole picture about President Trump midwifing this deal. It's called President Trump Peacemaker, and he goes into the prophetic elements there as well.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. It was 4 years ago that the British people voted to leave the European Union. Yet there's still a battle over implementing that decision. Britain is officially out of the Union, but the nature of their relationship is still a matter of bitter contention. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, that contention really took off this week, where as the government tried to push forward a new bill that would give them an edge in negotiations with the European Union. So as you said, Britain officially left the EU on January 1st of this year, and there was a kind of an agreement in place that will last throughout 2020. But what the relationship looks like between the UK and the EU beyond 2020, well, that's a big question mark at the moment. And so the same battle that you had with Brexit and one side trying to stop Brexit or to redo a referendum is now being played out all over again, where you've got, again, now one side trying to make Britain have a sort of Brexit that's going to keep them as close to the European Union as possible, where we're still getting a lot of our rules from the European Union. I mean, we talked a bit about some of these regulations and things like that on Wednesday's show, just globally, but that Britain, a lot of its rules, regulations for its different products would come from the European Union, a lot of its labor laws coming from the European Union, laws about how and what the government can do to support industries and what they can't do from the European Union. You know, there's a side within the UK that wants a rule by Brussels. And they're trying to weaken the Britain's negotiating position so that that happens, so that Britain ends up still being basically a subject of the European Union, even though not officially part of it. So the latest round of this, it all revolves around this withdrawal agreement. This was, like I said, was signed. And when the European Union signed it, they signed it promising that they would then work in good faith to have a trade agreement in place this year. That's not happened. That they have not been negotiating in good faith. They've been trying to use parts of this withdrawal agreement to twist Britain's arm and to kind of coerce Britain into subjecting themselves to rule from Europe. And one of the ways that they've done this is by kind of twisting, exaggerating part of this agreement that would to put then a trade barrier within the United Kingdom to make it good, to make it illegal in some circumstances for Britain to take, just move goods freely from England to Northern Ireland. You know, it would be like making it illegal for America to move goods from Washington to Alaska. That kind of thing, creating internal trade barriers. Now, no government could countenance that, so the British government has pushed back with a bill of their own to make that impossible. And this is what has caused the big fracas this week. The pro-EU camp has screamed that in trying to thwart this, the British government is breaking international law, they're claiming. And they're claiming that because this goes against the treaty, Britain is behaving like a rogue state, that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is basically behaving like Vladimir Putin, or worse, like Hitler. Just the most extreme kind of complaints that you can imagine. And I don't know, it might sound arcane and technical. It hasn't been over here. You know, this has been front page news every day of the week. This has been blasting out from the BBC just about round the clock on their news channels. It's been a big deal now with this push of, well, we're being run by a bunch of illegal gangsters, and the British government fundamentally does not respect the rule of law. That's the narrative we're being pushed.
You know, it's not surprising that European officials would want to punish Britain. If you think of from their standpoint, and even just what we know about the European Union, they're trying to discourage other nations from doing what Britain did. And so they're trying to make this as difficult on Britain as possible. But the fact that you have so many British politicians that are so much in agreement with that is pretty extraordinary. But it really does match this trend that we've seen, especially in America, but also in Britain, in the Anglo-American sphere, where you have this bureaucratic state or this deep state that is undermining the will of the people, and they're basically trying to implement what they believe is correct, no matter what sort of length they have to go to do that.
Right, and this is where this kind of just gets really fascinating, where you there's just such a similar connection between this kind of deep state pro-EU movement in the UK and this deep state anti-Trump movement in the United States. It's exactly the same kind of thinking. You know, we know best, we experts know best. Now, the people, they might be allowed some choice within certain limited parameters. But you do something outside of that, like vote for President Trump, who acts and talks outside the norm and negotiates outside the norm, like we just heard from Brent. Or you vote for Brexit, that's not really that's outside of their kind of worldview. Well, then they oppose you and they fight you every inch of the way, because there's this same arrogant spirit of we know better. And there are a lot of connections between these two kind of deep states. In the next Trumpet print edition, we've got that article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry that talks about how involved Britain was and British intelligence in the efforts to unseat President Trump. And he talks about, well, part of that reason had to do with Brexit. And you know, President Trump was very pro-Brexit. Mr. Obama was very anti-Brexit. They all had the same worldview, and so these kind of elite intelligence agencies and the head of MI6 and things like that were quite happy to try and work against President Trump. You've seen the same thing this week as this news story has rolled on, with Joe Biden coming out and criticizing the British government and pushing them against this law. You've had a bunch of Democratic senators also come out, and some of these Democratic senators, by the way, you know, are basically terrorist supporters, terrorist sympathizers. You know, they have links to the same Irish Republican terrorists who have assassinated members of the royal family, tried to assassinate Margaret Thatcher, some of those kind of things. They're some pretty evil people. You're having now the same deep state in America reaching out more and more and trying to get involved in the Brexit debate. And really, it's the same spirit behind that's motivating both of those. And it's the same kind of bringing down Britain and America from the inside. And Mr. Flurry's Trumpet print edition talks about some of that commonality. And this is where, for a British person, Mr. Flurry's book Great Again just really comes alive. Because if you look at that on the surface, all the examples Mr. Flurry's bringing up in there are about American politics. And you do have to understand a certain amount of American politics to get a lot of that. But at the same time, the fundamental reality that he's talking about, the spiritual dimension, what the Bible is saying, you know, we've seen that reflected in British politics too. You need that book to understand what's happening in America. You need that book to understand what's happening in Britain too, though. You cannot understand British politics without Great Again, without America Under Attack. And so, you know, that connection, I think, shows the importance of understanding that spiritual dimension, understanding that there is, you know, the Bible talks about blessings being given to Britain, America, these descendants from Israel, God blessing these nations for a purpose. And then, you know, well, of course, the Bible also talks about a devil who hates God's plan, who's then attacking those same nations, and those attacks are being allowed through, and you're seeing him attack these countries from the inside. That's a reality that you have to understand British politics, that you have to understand the hope behind these news stories. And so that's why you need that book to understand what's happening in Britain too, with the Brexit debate.
Yeah, the alignment between America and Britain, and the fact that you see the same story playing out with slightly different characters, and it's playing out with a slightly different narrative. But as you said, the fundamentals are identical between these two countries. It really is extraordinary, and I highly recommend that you read that. It's a major article coming up in the next Trumpet edition. It's called Treason in America and Britain. It's about a 6-page article that describes a lot of this history, just how involved these British agents were in the American political scene. But he also mentions Brexit as well, and draws some of those parallels between what's happened in America and what's happening in Britain. An excellent resource to look forward to. That will be up on the website next week. We'll link to Great Again in the meantime in the show notes for today's program. We appreciate that very much, Richard. A report this week from the Asia Society Organization warns that China's economic projects in countries around the world could be used for more militaristic purposes. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is an interesting development, because ever since Chinese President Xi Jinping first started talking about the so-called Belt and Road Initiative back in 2013, he has just insisted that it's strictly for peaceful economic purposes. The Belt and Road, it's meant to be kind of a new and improved revival of the ancient Silk Road network that allowed trade to just flourish between Asia and the Middle East and Europe. And so China's been persuading nations in all these regions to take out huge loans from China to build roads and railway lines and ports and all kinds of other infrastructure. And China has always said to the other countries, it's only for trade. You're going to get richer. We're going to get richer. It's a win-win for everyone. Now, there has always, from the beginning, really been evidence showing that China had military goals tied into the Belt and Road. But now this new report has been released by the Asia Society Policy Institute, and it shows just how serious all of the military potential of the Belt and Road Initiative really is. So this is it's a 64-page in-depth report, and it talks about just how many of the Belt and Road projects are in what it calls strategic strong point sites in countries such as Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Myanmar, and Cambodia. And the report argues pretty compellingly, I think, that China could easily weaponize these projects. It talks about just how suspicious it is that many of the ports that China is constructing are built up to a level that meets national defense requirements. So they go beyond what would be required for strictly civilian purposes. And then it discusses China ramping up its military exercises and also increasing sales of weaponry to Belt and Road countries. And one part of the report kind of summarizes a lot of this, and it says, quote, China is creating a Sino-centric ecosystem of trade, technology, finance, and strategic strong points that could pave the way for military use. So it's not necessarily anything that we've not known about, but the level of detail and clarity of this report does show just how dangerous China's activities here have become.
Does the report give any indication on just what its broader strategic interests would be in ramping up its military usage.
Yes, it does go into just the overarching goal here, and a lot about what's at stake for the United States, because it really is a zero-sum game. Because, where China's influence in Asia increases, America's almost always suffers a proportionate decrease. And this report brings out that China is fully aware of that. And its preparations, or at least its apparent preparations to militarize parts of the Belt and Road, are actually being carried out with that understanding fully in mind. One section of the report says, China's activities aim to undermine American influence and role as a security guarantor in the Indo-Pacific region. And then the report encourages the U.S. to work with India and Australia and Taiwan and Japan and other partner nations like that to prevent further military expansion by China. One line of it says, whether China can effectively weaponize the BRI will be a function of Beijing's choices and those made in Washington as well. So, you know, it's clear that China is making some just very dramatic preparations. There was one publication this week that wrote about this, the California Sun. Their headline for it was, "How Beijing Plans to Use New Project in Bid for World Domination." Mm-hmm. So, you know, that might sound a little sensational, but when you read this new in-depth Asia Society Policy Institute report, you see that it is about China pushing America out and dominating the region and even having eyes eventually on the world.
Where would you point people to understand the prophetic implications of this, and how are we viewing this prophetically speaking?
I would recommend that people read Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Trumpet. He has a new article called Where is the China-America Clash Leading? And that was in our August 2020 issue. And he goes through, you know, China's domineering in Asia and all of the power that it's gaining over many of the nations and shipping lanes there, and how that's often at the expense of American influence. And then after that, he focuses on a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52 about the U.S. losing sea gates that it once had control over and losing them to enemy powers such as China. Mm-hmm. So we really see this happening powerfully in many parts of the Indo-Pacific region because the U.S. has kept so much of that open for shipping and for trade for so many years. But now China is getting better and better established there and laying a foundation to be able to push the U.S. out. So for anyone who would like to understand this in that prophetic context, I would recommend that article by Mr. Fleury.
That prophecy about sea gates really is just such a specific prophecy that you can look at in terms of how America and Britain, these Anglo-American nations that the Bible refers to as Israel, gained possession of these very strategic assets, and then how those have been lost. And it is really troubling just how aggressive China has been in accumulating those, stripping those assets away from America and Britain, and the way that it threatens to use those going forward. It seems like the world is pretty much asleep to that. Britain and America don't seem to be particularly concerned about it, but China is definitely exhibiting a lot of strategic thinking in the way that it has approached that. And I think anyone, as you mentioned, anyone who has not studied into those prophecies, you really have an eye-opening study ahead of you if you look at that article that Jeremiah referred to, Where is the China-America Clash Leading? And it will take you to other resources that we have that really highlight that Seagate's prophecy. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. It appears China is funding another project aimed at increasing its power at America's expense. This one hits even closer to home. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Heritage Foundation put forward an interesting thought experiment in an article this week that he's like, imagine for a minute that there was a far-right organization in America that was funding and participating in riots across hundreds of U.S. cities. And then some information came to light that the Russians were funding this organization. And they said, well, if that were true, there'd be wall-to-wall news coverage on, like, all the networks over this story. And rightfully so, because that would be a huge story. We then pointed out that actually something very similar to that scenario is playing out on the far left. There have, over the summer, there have been protests and riots in over 1,400 American cities. People are still crunching the numbers, but so far they've ascertained that Black Lives Matter has been involved in 95% of those protests. It's an overt communist group with one of the co-founders had given a speech a couple years ago, even saying that it's not possible for a world to emerge where Black Lives Matter if it's under capitalism. And it's not possible to abolish capitalism without a struggle against national oppression. So this isn't a group about protecting Black lives. This is a group about abolishing capitalism in the United States, participating in protests across the country. And now it's coming out that they're raising funds for all these protests in cooperation with a group closely aligned with communist China. The Heritage Foundation report notes that if you go to the website for Black Futures Lab, that's a venture of Black Lives Matter to raise money for the organization. If you ask to send money to this to this Black Futures Lab, a note will come up explaining that Black Futures Lab is a fiscally sponsored project of the Chinese Progressive Association. Now, that's an association that many people have heard of, but it was founded in 1972 in San Francisco, basically to promote the People's Republic of China in the United States, foster good relations between the United States and China, and convince the American people that the Maoist system in communist China isn't so bad. And so now this organization, which is basically working on behalf of the Communist Party of China to promote communist values in the United States, has seen a great opportunity to do that by partnering with Black Futures Lab and raise money for these protests across the nation.
This really shouldn't be too much of a surprise to us, considering that Black Lives Matter is openly anti-capitalist, openly supportive of Marxism. The fact that it would have alignment with a country like China really is, it just shows birds of a feather.
Right, and is this not necessarily the first time they've even been caught with at least an ideological alignment with foreign communists? I mean, I think they've been very open that they are domestic U.S. communist, although one of the like founding heroes of Black Lives Matter is Asada Shakur, who was a Black Panther who killed a New Jersey state trooper back in the 70s, I think it was, and then fled to communist Cuba. And Black Lives Matter, some of the founders, they've published editorials praising Fidel Castro's communist system. So they've had high praise for Cuba's version of communism, and even have one of the kind of like their own who's been in asylum there in Cuba. So it was should definitely be known that they've aligned with even foreign, not even domestic, but even foreign communists over the United States. Now, this is kind of the first indication of fiscal ties or financial funding. We'll put in the show notes our book, He Was Right. There's a chapter in there on the communist infiltration of America was prophesied that covers a lot about what the Bible prophesies about the infiltration of foreign ideologies, anti-Bible ideologies, into America in the end time, and summarizes what the late Herbert W. Armstrong was writing about Soviet Union's role in pushing these communist ideologies in American universities, mm-hmm, and in American societies. Some statistics about like the amount of money the Communist Party USA was receiving from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, And then, of course, a lot of people thought that when the Soviet Union fell, that was kind of all over with. But, like I said, the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong were closely aligned nations, had closely aligned ideologies. And so even though the Communist Party of Russia is not as influential in Russia as it once was, the Communist Party of China is alive and well, and even kind of picking up some of the slack the Soviet Union left in financing Marxist revolutions around the world.
The Communist Infiltration of America Was Prophesied is the chapter in the He Was Right booklet, and it has a load of quotations from Herbert W. Armstrong and warnings that he gave decades ago about exactly what we see happening in the United States today. We thank you very much for that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break and be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Japan has a new prime minister. Who is he, and what does this mean for this major Asian nation? To learn the answers, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan's longtime prime minister, Shinzo Abe, officially resigned on Wednesday. This resignation was actually announced back in August when he said that it was due to health problems, but he only just stepped down this week, and Abe was the longest-serving prime minister in Japanese history. He served 1 year back in 2006 to 2007, and then eight more from 2012 until this week. So it really is the end of an era for Japan. And now there's a man named Yoshihide Suga. He was previously the chief cabinet secretary, and on Monday he was elected as the president of the Liberal Democratic Party that Shinzo Abe had been leading. That was Monday, and then on Wednesday, Japan's National Diet elected him and swore him in as Japan's new prime minister. So Yoshihide Suga is now the leader of the country with the world's third largest economy, and the fifth most powerful military, and the 11th largest population. So, you know, Japan is an immensely powerful and a very important nation, and this leadership transition that has just happened there gives us a lot to keep a close eye on.
So what do you know about this man so far that might give us an indication of what we can expect under his regime?
Yeah, well, Suga has been a strong ally of Shinzo Abe. He was really seen as Abe's right-hand man for most of the last 8 years. So I think for the most part, we should expect just quite a lot of continuity with Abe's policies. As far as how things go inside Japan, the people are very hopeful about Suga. He is a self-made politician. He's the son of a strawberry farmer in a somewhat remote part of the country. And he's just really stressed that he wants to serve the interests of the ordinary people and rural communities and that sort of thing. But in terms of foreign policy and security matters, I think we should mainly just expect continuity from Abe's approach. And that means being very vigilant about China's aggression and North Korea's aggression, and basically just continuing to build Japan's military power to be able to counter those kinds of threats and to be able to stand up to them and just kind of assert Japan's interests in an Asia that is becoming more and more tense and just, you know, peppered with flashpoints. So I think we especially need to watch how Suga views the Senkaku Islands there in the East China Sea, because Chinese maritime law enforcement vessels have been just pressing their claims to those disputed islands to just very worrisome levels lately. So that gives Suga a lot to carefully watch. But in general, when it comes to foreign policy and security matters, continuity will mean that Prime Minister Suga will continue just, you know, kind of trying to walk the tightrope in between the United States and China and just continue trying to build up and normalize Japan's military.
We have watched how Shinzo Abe militarized Japan over a period of a number of years, and it does point to what we would expect from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, the fact that Japan would play a fairly major role in an upcoming Asian alliance, you wouldn't expect much of a deviation from that path, even with a change of leadership.
That's a great point. Yes, and I think that's really why this transition is significant, because of the continuity that it signals. But Japan's return to militarism, whether it's under Shinzo Abe or Suga, it is something that is historically very alarming. You know, we know that history shows that the Japanese military machine during times of conflict can be just unusually fanatic and destructive. The tragic history of World War II shows that clearly, and so do several other chapters of Japanese wartime history. And it was because of all that history that the Allied powers at the end of World War II forced Japan to renounce war and to become a pacifist nation. And they actually made Japan dependent on the United States for its security and protection. So with all that history in mind, it is very sobering, I think, today to see Japan, whether it's under Abe or Suga or whoever else may come, just to see them continue this trend toward militarism. So the history shows that that's alarming, but also, as you said, the prophecy shows that it's very alarming. The Bible says that one of the main players in the final world war will be a group of Asian nations called the Kings of the East. And Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, he was the editor-in-chief of the Plain Truth news magazine, that's really the Trumpet's forerunner. And he said, based on his understanding of Bible prophecy, he did believe that Japan would play a big role in that block. And then if you look at Ezekiel chapter 38, it even lists some ancient names for Japan, showing that it would be part of that block. So when we keep all those scriptures in mind, and the Bible passages showing just how destructive that final world war will be, then I think that shows us why it is significant to keep on watching Japan continuing to militarize.
Well, we will link to our trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's Toward Militarism, in the show notes. And thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. The United States is declaring that as of tomorrow, all international sanctions against Iran have been restored. Well, just about the entire rest of the world disagrees. So this sets up an interesting showdown. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yep. Saturday night at 8 p.m., sanctions are back up, all of them that were brought down with the Iran nuclear deal. And that's according to the United States, who has basically said and told the other UN Security Council nations that that's the way it's going to be. President Trump is going to be talking at the UN General Assembly on Tuesday and no doubt is going to be bringing this up. And there will be some type of showdown to see whether this is going to be tested by other nations. Of course, what these sanctions mean is that the U.S. is going to reimpose a ban on any uranium enrichment that was allowed from the nuclear deal. It's going to ban all missile activity of the Iranians. And it's going to, again, seek that indefinite extension of the arms embargo that the rest of the world wants to see expire midway through October. And it's basically put the United States against Russia and China and European allies that want the deal to continue and said, we dare you. We dare you to go ahead and trade with Iran after they do such things, at least in these areas. And if you do that, we will start sanctioning your companies. We'll sanction British companies if we have to. We'll sanction the Russian military if we have to, even more than we are, and so on. So what's interesting about this is the way it is being reported. I think I sent you, Mr. Hilliker, an article by Matt Lee, who's one of the best AP journalists in foreign policy. And his second paragraph says it this way. He says, virtually alone in the world, the Trump administration will announce on Saturday UN sanctions that were eased are going to be back up. And I think the way that his editors are, in a way to show that the United States is alone in this, in that acting against international opinion. And perhaps they're probably wrong in this, because apparently international opinion is always right. But it does highlight what we've been talking about for a number of years now, that you have one man leading one nation that has put a stop to Iran's rise and the power that Iran had. We had a former president of the United States that sought through the nuclear deal to empower Iran. That was the goal. That's not just the trumpet talking. That's other commentators talking. That was his goal. And you had the United States come along, tear up that deal, and now is forcing the other nations that want it to continue, forcing them to renege on the deal as well.
Once again, the Trump administration defying the international community, and a lot of people saying, well, does he even have the authority to do this? And yet he does it.
Right. And, you know, this gets back to the failure of the nuclear deal when it was put into place. The other nations will say that you already withdrew from the nuclear deal, so you can't put up the sanctions anymore. You're out of it. You can't say that they're non-compliant, Iran. You're out of the deal. However, when the deal was struck, it was struck with a handshake. Nothing was signed. And the reason that this was the case is because the Obama administration would have liked to have a treaty with Iran, but that was based on support that he would have to get in the Senate, and the support wasn't there. And so to formalize the nuclear deal, there was a big mistake that was made. It was basically an executive action that was made and signed onto by the UN Security Council. It was a Security Council resolution that enacted the nuclear deal. Now, the United States is still a member of the Security Council, and so the United States executive power now can renounce that part of the UN Security Council deal if it chooses. And so it is legally allowed to snap back these sanctions because it is still a member of the Security Council. And so what we have here, if we look at just zoom out and talk in terms of biblical prophecy, is that we have this man, the leader of the United States right now, President Trump, that Mr. Gerald Flory has talked about, is a prophesied Jeroboam, somebody that existed in the ancient Israel, a king that was brought up, that was raised up to save the nation from being blotted out. There were people that wanted the nation of Israel to be blotted out, and this man was raised up to temporarily save it, not by his own righteousness, but because of God's mercy. And you have this same thing take place. And Mr. Flory's talked about this in his article, The Barack Obama Mystery. I think it was Last Trumpet or the one before, two trumpets before. And he says that you had a United States president, Obama, that did seek to blot out the nation of Israel, whether you're talking internally with the United States by his policies to fundamentally transform the United States, or talking about the Jewish state in the Middle East. The United States sought to empower Iran because Iran wanted to blot out Israel, wipe Israel off the map. So the language is the same. And President Trump is in power right now, and he has temporarily saved that from happening.
Well, thank you, Brent. We will link to the article that Gerald Flory wrote in our recent Trumpet print edition, The Barack Obama Mystery. That article uncovers and exposes what went into the creation of this Iran nuclear deal to begin with that Donald Trump is trying to undo. Fascinating story that it's very important that you read that. We'll put that in the show notes for the program today. The Caribbean island of Barbados made a stunning announcement this week, stunning at least to the staff of the Trumpet. To learn what it is, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Barbados announced this week that they were going to remove the Queen from head of state and become a republic by November 2021. Now, this is a pretty rare and significant event when it comes to the royal family. It's not something that happens every day. The last state to remove the Queen as head of state was Mauritius, and that was all the way back in 1992. The Queen is a head of state of 16 different countries, including Canada and Australia. So this is an important setback for the royal family, and it looks like there's a lot of other countries that could well follow Barbados. That, for example, Jamaica for a long time has been getting pretty close to doing something similar. And I think what is remarkable about this is we've been pointing to a long time now, the last two or three years, saying that there's important changes going on within Britain's royal family, that we need to watch and understand the royal family. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory, he had a cover article on the Trumpet print back in September 2017 called The Fall of the British Royal Family. Back there, he talked about this movements in Canada and Australia to get rid of the royal family. And in that article, Mr. Flory wrote, "What is wrong with Britain and the royal family? this issue is far more important than people generally realize. And you know, he went through some of the recent tragedies that have been going on in that family back in 2017. And then towards the end, he wrote, God is already changing the way he deals with the royal family, which explains why 2017 has been so tragic so far. Then he writes, this change is a sign of terrible things to come upon Britain in particular, as well as America and the Jewish nation. It explains the rapid decline we're witnessing in Britain's royal family. So, you know, Mr. Flurry said there, Britain's royal family is going into a rapid decline. And what have we seen since then? You know, we've seen some of the worst news events for the royal family since the death of Princess Diana, if not ever, or at least for decades. You know, you've got this whole fallout now with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, and they've really gone right over to the radical left. And now you've got the first country to leave from being ruled by the monarchy, or at least having the monarchy as head of state since 1992. And again, could be the first of quite a few nations to keep quitting. So, I mean, Mr. Flurry's forecast there of rapid decline has really been proven true. So this is worth looking into. And we have a book called The New Throne of David that, you know, goes into that change that Mr. Flurry talks about, what changed in the royal family, what precipitated this rapid decline, what this means, and also just the massive hope in this subject too, because, you know, there's a very important reason and a very hopeful reason that God is changing the way that he's dealing with this royal family here. And it's something that is bound up with so many scriptures in the Bible. So just more evidence here of a specific forecast Mr. Flurry made, and that book has tons more information about that.
All right, excellent. Richard, I would also recommend that you listen to Brad McDonald's Trumpet Daily Radio show. He spoke about this yesterday on that program, and he made the point that when the Queen dies, you're likely going to see many more countries following the same path that Barbados did here, that really the dismantling of what is left of the British Commonwealth, just underlining the point that you made there, Richard. But we will link to both of those in the show notes, and we appreciate that. We will finish with a couple more stories from America. First, a brief update on the seventh hurricane of the 2020 Atlantic hurricane season, Hurricane Sally. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Hurricane Sally hit Alabama on Wednesday. It was a Category 2 hurricane, which is fairly small as far as hurricanes go, but it still did considerable damage due to the areas it hit. Hit some high populated areas, inundated many homes, killed three people. And one of the interesting things is that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has labeled this as the seventh hurricane, but the 18th tropical storm, named tropical storm of this season. And mid-September is the peak of the hurricane season, so there might be a few more before that's over. So they said there could be as many as 25 named tropical storms this hurricane season, which if that does happen, would basically make it the worst hurricane season in terms of, or the worst storm season in terms of the number of tropical storm since 2005. And the second worst since they've been able to track those sort of things with satellites. I think 1966 is about the time they start being able to tell how many tropical storms formed in a given year. So we'll put our book Why Natural Disasters in our show notes. That just does give some explanation as to why God allows things like this to occur. Why natural disasters like Hurricane Sally occur in our world and their prophetic significance.
And then one last story. There's been an unrelenting attack on American history. And Andrew, how is President Trump proposing to fight back against that?
Yeah, well, this Thursday was Constitution Day. It was the 233rd anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. And so to commemorate that day this year, President Trump gave a speech announcing that he would soon be signing an executive order to launch something called the 1776 Commission. And the purpose of the 1776 Commission is to fight back against the 1619 Project. We've talked about the 1619 Project quite a bit on this show before. It's the New York Times initiative to educate younger Americans that they said the real founding of America was 1619, when the first slave ship arrived in Virginia. And then it relies heavily on like Howard Zinn's A People's History of America to try to make the case that America was a nation founded on genocide and oppression. Now, President Trump and his speech, if you look up some of the details about that, specifically singles out Howard Zinn and the 1619 Project and really condemned how these projects are making young Americans ashamed of their history. And so he's trying to get a government initiative to do the 1776 Commission to just really bolster the positive aspects about American history, everything good it's done for the world. And prophetically, we're really looking at this because of prophecies like the one in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 and Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 about civil war in end time Israel. And really, when you look at politics in the United States, probably from about the time Nancy Pelosi was made Speaker of the House in 2006 to the time President Trump was elected in 2016, you kind of had this 10-year slide into radical leftist ideology like that being exposed in the 1619 Project. Mm. Now you're having a president really stand up and push back with a very different narrative of American history. And what you're getting is two sides in a very heated debate over America's legacy in the world. And for like prophecies about civil war, you do need two sides to fight a war. And really, that is what you're seeing. I mean, it's kind of positive news that you're actually having some people step up for the positive things America's done in history. But it also shows that this this campaign to move America into far-left ideology is not going to be a gradual slide like it's been for the past decade or so. It is going to be more of a head-to-head conflict.
All right. Well, we do appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Albert Einstein: intellectual growth should commence at birth and cease only at death. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.